Hi, I'm David Crowe, and welcome to episode 42 of The Infectious Myth. Thank you for being a listener. If you have a comment or want to suggest a future guest, you can email me at david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com, like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth, or follow us on Twitter at infectiousmyth. During a live broadcast, you can phone at 888-874-4888. We're on iTunes and other podcast programs for downloads after the live show. Remember that I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you. Today's guest is Judith Levine, and our topic is much more than sexual assault. We will talk about where sexual assault blurs into bad behavior and where bad behavior blurs into misunderstandings, and how even good consensual sex can become a problem the morning after or later. Sexual assault is a minefield for a man to talk about. Men represent almost all the perpetrators. Powerful men in particular have historically behaved and still are like they believed that sexual access to less powerful women and sometimes men was one of the perks of their job. Women who bring charges of sexual assault, especially against powerful men, are often crucified in the media. We know that the legal process is so ugly that many women simply decline to bring charges, or they are in a position such as a job or marriage in which they would have to choose economic destruction for a chance, not a certainty, at justice. On the other hand, there is a push to criminalize or make sanctionable behavior that seems part of the normal, clumsy, fumbling sexual explorations of young people by insisting on affirmative consent, which is great in principle, even if there are no words. If your partner moves towards you and you kiss them, they want more. If they don't, they don't want more. But when it ends up in a tribunal on one part, most likely the man says that she did or said things indicating she wanted more, and the other party, most likely the woman, says the opposite. We're still in the he said, she said world. Worse yet, many new tribunals for sexual assault appear to stack the process in the favor of the accuser and against the defendants, which would all be okay if we could believe that people never lied about sexual assault, but as the recent Rolling Stone article illustrates, it's quite possible that a woman would fabricate an entire story. And how do we admit that without heading to the other extreme and assuming that this occurs in the majority of cases and that a woman has to be shredded in court before we will believe her? My guest today will hopefully help us sort this out. Judith Levine is the author of several books, including Harmful to Minors, The Perils of Protecting Children from Sex, dating to 2002, which was won the LA Times Book Award in 2002 and was named by sex educators as one of the history's most important books on sexuality. She's also written My Enemy, My Love, Man-Hating and Ambivalence in Women's Lives, Do You Remember Me? A Father, a Daughter, and a Search for Self, and Not Buying It, My Year Without Shopping. Some of her recent columns or articles include Feminism Can Handle the Truth in Boston Review, Campus Rape Rules Are About Punishment, Not Sex, To Stop Campus Rape, Let Kids Grow Up. Judith is also on the board of the National Center for Reason and Justice, which advocates for people who they believe have been falsely accused or convicted of crimes against children. I think reason and justice are two reasons why I'm interviewing her today. And welcome to the show, Judith.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yes, and before I forget, I should mention that your website is judithlevine.com, so afterwards people can get more information there.
Right.
The case that first got me interested in this issue was an article by Emily Yaffe in the in Slate magazine, I think, about the Drew Sterrett case, and I'll just summarize that briefly, and then I'll get your comments on it, and you can correct me if I got any of the important details wrong. So Drew Sterrett roomed at UMichigan with another male student. A young woman they both knew knocked on the door and asked if she could sleep in their room because her roommate had other people staying there. The boys thought she'd crash on the floor, but she crawled in with Drew, and pretty soon they were kissing and then noisily having sex, to the point that the boy on the lower bunk sent a Facebook message, "It is the modern world," complaining about this. They had sex three times that night, and everything seemed to be okay, although both were a bit embarrassed because they weren't romantically involved and all were in the same circle of friends. But when the woman's mother found her diary, at this point she said the sex wasn't consensual, perhaps to preserve her image as a virginal, studious young woman. There was a university process that sanctioned the man, and he felt it was impossible for him to continue his studies, so he withdrew, and now there is a big lawsuit against the university. So, Judith, what would be your thoughts on this case, and what does it illustrate?
Well, before I begin, I just wanted to clarify for your listeners what affirmative consent is and where such policies are being put in place. Affirmative consent is a standard by which universities and colleges, either individually or through a state system, are adjudicating claims or accusations of sexual assault. What they say is instead of the old standard or the old standard of proof, which was that the woman said no or resisted sex in one way or another, it doesn't have to be forcefully, it can just be she said so, or she was sleeping, right, or something like that. Affirmative consent changes that to yes means yes, and by that they mean at the beginning of the sexual encounter and at each stage inside of the sexual encounter, both people have to indicate, and it depends on the policy, either by word or by word or deed or by sound or by body movement, body language, that they indeed consent to continuing with the sex act. So that's what affirmative consent is, and it's not being practiced anyplace outside of colleges and universities at present. So about this case, Emily Yaffe uses this case because it is the scariest, you know, the worst case possible.
Right.
And it's not that unusual. I mean, there are, we don't know how many, but there are probably, we know there are numerous, usually men, on campuses who have been accused and convicted, you could call it, of sexual assault, who are now suing those universities because they felt they did not get due process. They were considered to be, as in this case, guilty until proven innocent. And even sometimes when there is no clear resolution of the case, the young man can be asked to leave the campus either temporarily or forever. So I think in this case and in affirmative consent, generally, there are lots of different assumptions at play, politics at play, history at play. We could talk about each one of those.
Right.
The assumption is that people, that sex is something that is very clear-cut, you know or you don't know, that you want to have it. The good thing about it, I think, is that it's a good thing to check in from time to time when you're having sex with somebody, and just because you married them or just because you said yes in the beginning doesn't necessarily mean you want to keep going. So it's good to kind of be aware of that, you know, listen, watch, you know. I don't think anybody people who object to affirmative consent wouldn't want people to be doing that.
I don't think the opposite of affirmative consent is talking to your partner.
Consent.
And I think everybody who cares about their partner understands that if you talk about things, suggestions about doing different things or, you know, other things or, you know, why don't we go away and, you know, have a weekend together, something like that. I mean, I think most people would say that the more you talk about sex with your partner, the better, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you have to say, is when we talked earlier, like, can I under your shirt now? Can I kiss left breast? That seems a little excessive.
Yeah, so this case is a case in which all of the awful things that can happen with this kind of policy have happened, and that is that the young man did not receive due process. You know, in a regular court of law, a person is presumed innocent until proven guilty, and it's up to the prosecution to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the guy did it, or the woman and whoever it is. In this case, usually the standard is what they call preponderance of evidence, and that just means, like, 50.5% or something like that of the evidence seems to this board to affirm that indeed she was sexually assaulted. Another problem with this case, with these policies, is that what sexual assault is often very, very broadly defined. It can mean anything from just being like touched in the smallest way, in a way that you didn't like. So instead of the woman just like slapping the guy or telling him to, you know, go F himself, she is not, you know, she can charge him with sexual assault. And the consequences are really disproportionate often to the act. That is, not only is the guy going to be expelled from school, he might never be able to get into school again. And furthermore, being found guilty in a university situation does not preclude either the woman or the school going to the state and making, you know, making an accusation there. So a person could also, you know, be liable to a criminal prosecution. And we don't really know whether it's admissible in court if the guy has been found guilty by his college, or whether that would, you know, whether that would be influential to the prosecution, to bringing an indictment. All of those kinds of things, you know, are up in the air. And so they make the possibility of being wrongly convicted even scarier. So because you don't have as much evidence, you don't have any of the due process, you can't, you can't appeal it. You know, there's just kind of the so-called the defendant or the accusee really has no rights.
Well, I think what's also remarkable about this case is there was an unwilling witness to the whole thing. Mm-hmm. The boy in the bottom bunk was quite upset about the two having quite loud sex above him. And yet, even the fact that he could tell that the sex was very obviously consensual, that didn't stop the process from basically punishing the boy. Although I'm not sure it ever actually reached a specific conclusion, that they asked the boy not to register in any of the courses with the girl and not to be found in the same location, which he felt was virtually impossible.
So there are different kinds, right? As you're saying, there may be different punishments meted out to the person. And, you know, colleges are small communities. Reputations are easily lost or gained. Now, certainly many women who have been sexually assaulted fear that should they come forward, they will also be ostracized by the boys. Friends, or worse than ostracized, she might be threatened or have violence done to her. So it's always difficult to bring an accusation of sexual assault. It's difficult to convict someone, which I think is probably good. I think it's good that it's hard to convict anybody of a criminal charge, because especially in the U.S. the consequences of a sex offense are so much worse, really, than the consequences for any other criminal offense. Every criminal defendant in this country, and everybody who's been to prison or has been convicted of a crime, has many, many, many what they call collateral consequences after they have finished paying their dues. And that is, you know, they can't work in certain places. They can't live in public housing. They can't get food stamps. They can't, you know, there's many, many, many things that make it very hard to have a life. But sex offenders, that's multiplied 100-fold. They can't live within a certain number of feet of a park or a bus stop or a school. They can't put up Halloween decorations or Christmas decorations. They can't, in some places, the word sex offender is printed on their driver's license. They may have to go around to their neighbors and tell them that they're a sex offender. They can't live with their own children. They can't talk to other people on the phone who have children. I mean, their lives are, they are so, so alienated and exiled, really, from civilized society that many, you know, live under bridges and, you know, and certainly emotionally and socially and in every way, they're kind of dead to the world. So any kind of sexual accusation against a person is terrifying and highly, highly consequential.
Right. I was just yesterday, Salon magazine had a year-end review, and they talked about sexual assault, but they kind of conflated the terms sexual assault, sexual violence, and rape. And it, when we were talking earlier, you made the point that a rape or sexual assault does not necessarily include violence, but they use the term sexual violence as if it was interchangeable, which kind of implies that this whole range of sexual misbehavior, from violent rape through to, you know, an unwanted touch, are all violence.
Well, I think there's the colloquial violence, and there is the violent felony, you know, which is a more as a term of art. Forcing someone to have sex against her will, whether or not you use a knife or a gun to her head or hold her down, is, I think you could certainly call it an act of violence, just as we might say that you're doing emotional violence to me. But I think the point you're bringing up is important, that there is a very wide range of coercion in the world. There's bribery, there's, you know, implied threat. Lots of people do lots of things, not entirely willingly. And furthermore, the kinds of acts that can be done to a person, you know, talk about sex offenses and the collateral consequences of sex offenses. If you flash somebody, or in some cases in some states, if you urinate on a tree, you know, if you show your genitals in some way, even if you're not, you know, you don't mean to, you can be found guilty of a sex offense. And so that, you know, somebody peeing on a tree that you happen to notice out of the corner of your eye is quite different than somebody, you know, climbing in your window with a gun and forcing you to have intercourse. So, and it is true that the law does treat those different kinds of offenses differently, but often what happens after the fact is, whether you've served 3 years or 30 years, the same things will come down on you afterwards. So it really doesn't matter what you've done. And I'd say even just the label sex offender is, you know, equals, you know, you're really the most despised category of person in the United States, at least. So you're right that the definitions of what a sexual assault is, and this is especially true for child sexual abuse, is so wide, so confounded. Different studies use different definitions, different surveys. For instance, the survey that says that 1 in 5 women is sexually assaulted while on campus, that survey also included that you were really drunk. Not you were so drunk that you couldn't consent, but you were just really drunk. Now, if you included everybody who had sex while they were drunk, that would be practically everybody.
So in other words, if you willingly had sex while you were drunk and you woke up the next morning and you were quite fine with the fact that you'd had sex the night before and weren't upset about it, that would still be classified as a sexual assault because you couldn't really form consent because you were so drunk.
That would sort of be irrelevant, because if you thought it was okay, then it wasn't assault in your mind. Although it does happen that, you know, women and you read about these stories where a woman had sex, you know, under the influence of one thing or another, wakes up, feels sort of stupid about it, and her friends say to her, that was sexual assault, even if she didn't think so before. So these definitions are so broad that people are confused. I mean, it's confusing in the best of circumstances, but I think that this kind of mushiness of definitions makes it even harder. The mushiness of the definitions of sexual assault change with culture. So that, for instance, if you're in a culture where it's okay for a man to do anything he wants to his wife, including, you know, killing her, then there's no such thing as marital rape. Whereas I think it was a great triumph of the women's movement that in the 1970s and 80s, we were able to show and then get into the law that a man raping his wife is rape, even if he's married to her. So that's on one end of it. You know, you don't recognize anything as rape. And then on the other end is you start to call everything rape. And, you know, then there's many, many things in between. And those ways of thinking and feeling affect a person's experience of sex. so that you might, you know, when I was old enough to have grown up kind of before the women's movement, I was lucky to be young enough to be in the women's movement, but, you know, in the sexual revolution, for instance, you just had sex with anybody, and you often did it, like, I wouldn't say not consenting, but certainly not thinking about it all that much. And I think that, you know, and I know that later on in my life, when I looked back at certain experiences colored by a feminist consciousness, I thought of those experiences as more coercive than I thought of them at the time. So, you know, history really changes how we feel about sex, how we think about, you know, what happens to us and what we do.
But it seems like, as I think you said earlier, in the criminal case, there's either severe sanctions or there's none. And, you know, being charged in the United States with a felony, that, like you say, has lifetime consequences. So if there's kind of this knife edge between it is or it isn't, and if they decide it's not sexual assault, you walk on with your life as if nothing happened. Well, there's some consequences. And if it is, then there's massive consequences. So you talked to me earlier about restorative justice, and I just wanted to talk about a case that happened recently. It's ongoing in Canada. A dental school in Halifax at Dalhousie University had a closed Facebook group with 13 male dental students who made sexist and violent posts in this private group. For example, in one post, members of the group were encouraged to choose between two female students in the same faculty and vote for which one to hate, and then the F word. Another showed a picture of a woman with the caption, "Bang until stress is relieved or girl is unconscious." So somehow this group, the postings in this group became public, and there is now a process of what they call restorative justice ongoing. But a woman who is on the board of the Campus Sexual and Gender Resource Center said the following: "There are some things that are clear. What's clear is that there are men who are dentistry students who joked about raping and sedating women to rape them, and we are allowing them to continue on pursuing their professional degrees at Dalhousie. This means that Dalhousie," and then they named the president and the university, "are condoning their behavior and saying that they don't care about women's safety." And yet there's a process of restorative justice going on. So can you describe what that process might be and what some of the consequences might be?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what it is in this particular case, but what restorative justice is a set of practices that can happen either inside the criminal justice system or outside of it, in which the person who does harm, and in RJ they don't talk about the offender, the person who does harm and the person who has had harm done to her have a way of communicating with each other and a setting in which they can safely do that, in which both of them get to tell each other their stories, their experiences. They might also include other people in their families or friends or communities. And the goal of it is to not just to give the victim an airing of her dissatisfaction or hurt, but also to find real accountability for the person who does harm, to take real responsibility, be held accountable, and to make some kind of amends, either in word or in deed, to make it better. You know, and that can often be much more meaningful, I think, than the criminal justice practices, which put people on two sides. They never get to talk to each other. The victim often thinks that the prosecutor is her lawyer, but she's not. I mean, the prosecutor often doesn't even speak to the victim. So the victim often feels really pushed out of the process, number one. Then the offender, even if he did the crime, his job and his defense attorney's job is to convince a jury or a judge that he didn't do anything, or if he did something, he didn't do that much, or he wasn't that involved. And you start to tell that story enough times, and you begin to believe it. You know, I'm not responsible. Yeah. And so the promise of restorative justice is that behavior could really change, that people, once recognizing and hearing face-to-face the hurt that they have inflicted on someone else. I heard a story of a woman whose daughter was raped and killed, got to speak to the man who did this to her daughter, mm-hmm. and she said to him, "Your handprint was on my daughter's face. That's how hard you pressed against her." And he began to cry, and he said, "I didn't know I did that." And so, you know, to hear it from the victim's mouth or the mouth of somebody who loves that person can be much more powerful toward changing behavior. So maybe, hopefully, these young men at Dalhousie Dental School are getting to really talk to other people who are affected negatively by their actions, mm-hmm. and really getting to think about it. Now, the question of, first of all, it doesn't happen unless the victim wants it to happen. The offender right. cannot initiate a restorative justice.
Right.
It's not going to happen in the way that I think maybe this woman, the gender, whatever it's called, safety.
Sexual and Gender Resource Center, yeah.
She may think that the victim or victims were not involved in deciding to do it, and that just cannot happen. You know, I think the question of whether the university ought to impose sanctions on these men is not, you know, a wrong thing to say. I mean, I think that might be appropriate to do. And in fact, in the end of the restorative justice, that might very well be what happens.
But if
you know,
there,
that everyone decides that the guy should be, you know, suspended or something like that.
Right. I mean, but if there were two processes going on, it would probably be that the accused would not participate if they felt that the university, you know, that they would come to an agreement with the people they'd wronged, and then the university was going to throw them out anyway. Like, why bother participating in restorative justice if there's this other punishment hanging over their heads?
Like, yeah, you that's have true. And restorative justice is not about punishment, but it is about accountability. Those are not the only things. You know, the only punishment is not the only way. Retribution
right.
is not the only way. So, and you know, restorative justice processes happen in really, really, really serious harm, such as, you know, in Liberia, where there was a 12-year
right.
Civil war with atrocities committed against thousands and thousands of people by both sides. You know, the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commissions mm-hmm. are restorative justice bodies. So, it's true that entering restorative justice process in the criminal justice system, usually that will preclude a prosecution if your defense attorney, you know, can negotiate that for you. So
right.
there is something in it for the defendant as well. So, you know, the question of how serious this is, that story is interesting because it brings in the issue of speech and free speech.
Right.
You know, were they actually doing violence or were they talking about doing violence? If they're actually threatening people, then that is illegal to do. If they were
right.
just
I think
joking,
as far as I can tell, they were just making obnoxious posts, and there was no indication that they intended to do any of those things. They were
there was
locker room talk. And so if it did go to court, there's quite a good chance that it would be thrown out because it was considered to be a private conversation, however despicable it was. So the restorative justice may very well provide more to the victims, who were victims even if they'd never known about it, because the attitude of the boys to the women in the dental class was probably quite negative, presumably. That there would be side conversations and comments and things like that. And so this has brought this all out into the open. So maybe it's better for everybody if the process works reasonably well.
Well, you know, all I can say about restorative justice is the retributive justice system is not working.
Yeah.
It is not reducing violence of any kind. It is disenfranchising millions and millions of people and destroying many communities, minority communities, and poor communities. So it's not working. It's time to try something else. You know, maybe
yeah.
this won't work, but we might as well try.
yeah. I think so. One concern I've had is that sexual assault laws are written in a general gender-neutral fashion, then it's nothing that says that sexual assault is a crime that only men can perform. Although in reality, you know, sexual assaults that involve coercion are almost always men. But in the case of a woman being too intoxicated to consent, what would happen if the man was clearly more intoxicated and, you know, the woman was clearly initiating sex? I mean, that could be construed as sexual assault, even though culturally a lot of people would have a hard time accepting that.
That's true. It could. I think it actually has happened that a woman has been charged by a man for sexual assault. It's not, you know, the canard is always that, you know, men will have sex no matter what. You know, doesn't matter whether they're coerced or anything, they still like it. And, you know, that's obviously not true. It's much more common that what happens is a woman is charged, not in this kind of affirmative consent situation, but in a statutory rape situation, so that you have, you know, a relationship between a 17-year-old boy and an adult woman, and then the mother finds out about it, and she's a teacher or something, she's lost her job, or she's indicted with rape of the boy. So that's the more common situation in which women are charged with sexual crimes. And then there is also violence between lesbian partners, right, which may not be sexual violence, but there certainly is partner, you know, violence and domestic violence in lesbian couples. So, I think it's a good thing that rape, is not defined by gender. It used to be, and age of consent used to be different for boys and girls, and it still is in some places. It still is very true that statutory rape and other offenses of consensual minor sex are more harshly punished if the players are both boys than if they're boy and girl. And also in those cases when there's consensual sex between a boy, a minor boy, and a minor girl, it's almost always the boy who is found to be the aggressor. The reality of sexual assault, which is that like 99% of it is done by males, mm-hmm. and also our cultural biases about, you know, who should be having sex with whom and what does it mean to consent and who is it, you know, the other side is, you know, who's the gatekeeper and who's the aggressor. You know, the part about this for girls that I think is unfortunate is that they are now put in the position of having the old-fashioned position of having to be the gatekeepers of sex. They have to be saying no, or they have to be saying yes. It doesn't feel to me to be a mutual process, even though the policies are written as if it were a mutual process. I think in reality it comes down to the idea that girls are fragile, that girls don't really want to have sex, that girls are sort of differentially harmed, you know, that they are going, that it's likely that they're unsafe, this idea that women are unsafe, that sex is unsafe for women. These are really old-fashioned sexist notions of what, of women's sexuality or women's lack thereof.
And I mean, if women are more assertive in sex, there are going to be misunderstandings where maybe the man doesn't want to offend the girl at first and feels like he was sort of coerced into it but wasn't really that attracted to the woman. You know, those things may occur, and you know, does that rise to the level of a sexual assault? And you know, but it could, if the man for some reason wanted to get back at the woman and said, you know, when we had sex, I didn't want it, you pushed yourself on me. Right? I can see a lot more cases going against women if we get too far down this road of defining sexual assault really broadly.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the argument is made that you shouldn't not have, if a law is a reasonable law to have, we shouldn't not pass it because it might be abused. And
right.
So that's the argument for this. Like, yeah, people are going to, you know, mess with it and use it for revenge and all the rest of it. But if it is a good thing, we should have it anyway. And then, you know, exclude or throw out those cases in which it's being used illegitimately. So I think, you know, that's a good argument. But I think that the, you know, the dangers and the not possible, but clearly existing, violations of due process, of constitutional rights to due process, that's not possible. That is what these policies are in practice.
Right.
There's no way of not having them not, you know, violate people's rights. So,
right.
You know, another argument that's been made for affirmative consent is that it makes sex better. That Gloria Steinem and Michael Kimmel, who's a kind of male feminist, a guy who's written a lot about masculinity, right after California passed its the sort of prototype of this policy, they wrote an op-ed in the New York Times saying that, you know, yes is the sexiest word in the English language. They quoted James Joyce in Ulysses, and they said that it was saner and also sexier, that affirmative action was going to change sex to be saner and sexier. Now, first of all, for some people, yes is not the sexiest word in the English language. No is the sexiest word.
Right.
You know, people are interested in sadomasochism, for instance. No is much
right,
sexier
right.
than
yeah.
yes. This kind of policy also privileges a kind of person who uses words, for whom
right.
words are the main way of expressing things. And that, I think that has a kind of a class tone to it,
yeah.
that, you know, articulate intellectuals. I mean, I have a friend who says that her sexuality is voice activated. You know, somebody talks to her in the right way, she gets turned on. But people who are not used to expressing themselves mostly in words, this is not going to be sexier for them. But let's say it did make things, you know, let's say this idea, yes means yes, makes sex sexier. We don't need a law for that. You know,
right,
changing
right.
the culture, laws express societal values, and they can be really important in enforcing justice, such as, let's say,
right.
racial justice and sexual justice. You know, equality laws, sexual harassment laws, those are good laws. But if you want to change the sexual culture, passing a law that is going to punish one person for doing something that might or might not be an assault, and not only that, it's going to punish him with a lot less evidence than if he had been brought to a court of law. That's, I don't see that really making sex better. I mean, I can
yeah.
see a lot of people being just scared out of their wits to even, you know, to make a move. So,
right.
You know,
I mean,
so
if every step has to be verbal consent,
yeah.
and, you know, in sex there might be 20, 30, 40 steps, and all you need to do is forget to ask permission for one of them, or to, you know, you've asked so many questions you don't realize that there was not a response to one, then that could be sanctionable. You could get kicked out
it
of college
could,
or
you
whatever.
Know, it could be. I think that you're bringing up hypotheticals that are unlikely. I mean,
right.
this is really has to do with bad sex. It doesn't have to do with good sex. You know, if people
yeah.
are into it and they do it and, you know, nobody has to say anything, nobody's
right.
going to charge anybody with anything. It's
when
there's a misunderstanding. It's when people are angry. It's when people feel confused. It's when maybe there is a sense that there's some sort of coercion going on. I mean, those are the times when this policy is going to be used. So, so when I say it's irrelevant to good sex, it's really irrelevant to it. It's not going to
yeah.
make it better, and it's not going to make it worse. It's really not going to change sex. It is going to change the lives of people who have sex, who, you know, may be involved in, you know, college relationships, college romances, college sexual affairs can be, I mean, I remember being just kind of really angry at men almost all the time when I was in college.
Really?
I had tons and tons of sex with men, but I also, like, kind of walked around grumbling. You know, it was the time, it was, the early 70s, but I could, you know, I'm going to confess this on the radio, I could imagine myself bringing a case against somebody, just, you know, being a nasty bitch and doing that. And so,
right.
and I could ruin a person's life by doing that, you know.
And you probably would not have realized the consequences until it was too late. Like, you might have been really mad at a guy, And then, you know, it gets into the courts or into some kind of tribunal, and then it's too late to stop it. And it's like a rock rolling downhill gathering snow.
Well, you know, in fact, that really, in statutory rape cases, that happens all the time. A kid may feel that he or she is being exploited by an older person and wants to talk to somebody about it.
Yeah.
But the problem is that all of the helping professionals are mandated to report to the Child Protective Services that they suspect that some kind of crime is occurring or some sort of abuse is occurring.
Right.
And so the younger partner is unable really to talk to anyone. I have some friends, two men who have a son, and they're both, you know, one's a sex educator. They're both, like, quite progressive about sex.
Mm-hmm.
Their son had a relationship with an older man, and they were okay with it, but the man started to really act strangely and scarily to the boy, and so they wanted to get rid of this guy. They just wanted him to stop her, you know, threatening or hanging around their son. They did not want to go to the DA, but they had nothing. They had no recourse. They had nothing that they could do except to bring him into the criminal justice system. They didn't want to do it. The kid didn't want to do it. You know, so they were really over a barrel. And I think maybe had there been some organizations that were doing some sort of transformative justice or restorative justice, they might have been able to have some safe way of resolving this. But they didn't. So, and then what happens to that guy, not only what happens to the man who may find himself in prison, but the boy, and this happens all the time in these statutory rape cases, the younger partner feels that he or she has sent his or her lover to prison.
Right.
And that, the guilt and sadness of that is so harmful to the younger partner, way, way more harmful, I would say, that usually than anything that happened in this relationship. So it's not, you know, it's not satisfactory really to anybody involved. So that thing that you're talking about where it starts to snowball, that does happen. And it happened historically. For instance, in the 19th century, in cities, women and young girls who were not making enough money would often do kind of casual prostitution.
Mm-hmm.
Or they would have like a sort of a sugar daddy of some sort. Then, you know, the mother would find out the girl is staying out late at night. She wants her to listen to her mother. She wants to come home and give her paycheck to her mother and father. She goes to the judge and essentially says, tell her to come home and listen to her mother. And then the judge would often send the girl herself to some sort of reform school for her wrong sexual behavior, or they would do something to the guy. In those days, it usually was the girl who got sent off. Now the family doesn't have the girl's income. The girl's in prison, in jail. She's in some sort of, you know, juvenile lockup. So these ways of, you know, trying to resolve complicated personal misunderstandings and interactions through the criminal justice system just almost never works.
Right.
And this is a kind of mini criminal justice system run by people who don't know what they're doing, with ideologues in the galley, you know, in the gallery screaming for blood. You know, so it's everybody involved is compromised, and the consequences are very dangerous.
Right. I mean, you bring up an interesting point. I mean, in a sort of traditional justice system, you know, the accused gets punished, but does that necessarily make the victim actually feel better afterwards, thinking, okay, well, he got kicked out of university, he's not going to be able to go back to university, but what's happened to me? Well, nothing. You know, nothing's made it better for me. I'm not sure the man who was, you know, did bad things to me, sort of pushed me into sex somehow, is now really, really angry at me and probably hates me. So how much better off am I than if we'd be able to talk and get him to realize that his behavior was not acceptable and he needed to change?
Well, you know, there are a lot of victims who don't feel like talking to their assailants, and they do feel better if the assailant is punished. You know, there are a lot of people who would like, you know, somebody who murdered their family member to go to the electric chair.
Right.
So it's not universal. You know, people don't all have the same feeling about what justice means.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't. And, you know, often, you know, ideas about justice have to come from a rational place that is different from your emotions. So, like, if somebody killed, you know, my brother or my boyfriend or my mother,
right,
I might say, you know, I want that bastard to, you know, to go to jail for the rest of his life. And
right.
But rationally, I recognize that sending somebody to jail for the rest of his life is going to do nothing to change him. It's not necessarily going to make my life better unless I was afraid of him. I might, you know, that might be something. And, you know, it's cost a lot of money. It has all of these other consequences down the road. So I don't think that sending people to prison for life, no matter what they do, is a good idea. But
right.
I have to overcome, you know, my emotions. So there's a lot of people who don't, you know, for whom restorative justice is not the, you know, the preferred outcome. So, you know, you can't force anybody to want something. But, you know, one would hope, I would hope that as if we try to move toward a society in which we really think about why we have violence and try to really work on those things rather than just continuing to punish people in what is a very, very violent system, making people more violent, more angry, you know, less compassionate.
Yeah.
You know, I often feel that prison reinforces the very thing that makes somebody a violent felon. What makes someone a violent felon is a lack of empathy. And
right.
Prison reinforces solipsism. You have to watch out for yourself. You can't really trust anybody. You know, you have to show how tough you are. And so it just makes you more alienated, less empathic. You know, it's the
right.
opposite of what you would hope rehabilitation might be. So, you know, I guess I just generally have felt over the years I've become more and more of a prison abolitionist. I just don't think punishment works that well. But I don't think we can impute, you know, we can impose on other people what your feelings or my feelings might be about the best way, you know, to address violence.
Right. I guess what I'm saying is that, you know, even people who want, you know, harsh justice to be meted out against somebody who they feel harmed them, I wonder how many people feel after the process is completed that actually genuinely feel better.
Satisfying. Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's that feeling that you have is one of the motivators for having, you know, started the restorative justice system,
mm-hmm.
because a lot of victims didn't feel like they were satisfied. And especially a lot of people really just want to talk to the guy. I mean, they want to say, like, why did you do this to me? Tell me why you did this to me.
And there's also, I mean, with sexual crimes as opposed to murder, the restorative part can actually work. I mean, if you murder somebody, restorative justice is never going to bring that person back. But in the case of sexual misbehavior of some kind, whether it's sexual assault legally or not, there is a possibility that the person who's accused could actually reform their behavior and understand why their behavior was wrong. And that the person who brought the accusations against them would then feel validated. So everybody could go away feeling better, it seems like.
Yeah, I agree with you. And, you know, another thing we haven't really talked about is that it's really been shown that almost all rapes on campus are done by a very few people, and
mm-hmm.
those people are real rapists. They're not confused kids.
Right.
They're people who go out. They know they're raping. They plan to do it. They're not. They know they're raping, and they don't care.
Right.
So this is not just two kids who get in bed and are kind of confused and all the rest of it. So if
right.
you really want to deal with those guys, there's not that many of them. There may be ways of dealing with them that you don't have to punish everybody, you know, because
right.
of the actions of a few people. Their attitudes should be reformed, should be changed. There should be consequences for what they do. they should be held accountable. But you don't have to then think about the confusions and ambiguities of sex in terms of crime.
Well, talking about campus rape, it appears from what's happening that campuses are a very dangerous place, especially for the young women that go there. But, I mean, is that really true, that you're more likely to get sexually assaulted on a campus than, say, at work or in the military or something like that? Do we know that it's more dangerous?
No, we know that it is not more dangerous. What we know is that, you know, whatever the crime statistics show, it's that you're more, women are less safe off campus than they are on campus, that women in poor communities are more in more danger generally than those in wealthier communities. Campuses, for the most part, are pretty privileged and secure and, you know, well-policed places. So this idea that women, the people who are privileged enough to get a higher education, and that's more and more privileged in this country, are more endangered than everybody else, it's insulting to everybody else. So this one study of two campuses has come, you know, as far up as the President of the United States have quoted this thing, this one in five. And there was a good piece by a couple of researchers who did look at this situation, you know, where are you more likely to be sexually assaulted? And I think it's like 0.3% of women are sexually assaulted rather than 20%. So that's good news. You know, 20% of students are not getting assaulted. But I think it speaks to an idea about young women, and I would say this is racialized. It means white young women, or it means women of a middle or upper class, are fragile. They don't know what they're doing with their lives. They are kind of more attractive to criminals. That's like an old fashioned, idea that, you know, white women were being raped by black men. So there's a lot of, you know, really kind of nasty racialized and class bias, I think, written into this statistic about one in five college women is sexually assaulted.
Yeah, because it's sort of in this last year come up that there's this big crisis with sexual assault on campuses, but it's not really clear that the data supports that. And it does appear to be kind of a class thing because, you know, there's been also quite a bit spoken about sexual assault in the military, which does seem to be a really big problem. And one can certainly understand why it would be a huge problem with a very high number of men relative to women and a lot of people under a lot of stress and a very rigid hierarchy
and an organization whose raison d'etre is to do harm.
Yes.
So, to use violence to do harm to somebody.
So it's not surprising.
All the elements there.
Yes,
and the people who join the military tend to be working class people and poor people who can't get other jobs.
Right.
So those women go into the military to better themselves, to be able to get a better job, and then they find themselves, you know, sexually assaulted. There's a huge amount of evidence that people who are poorer are much more likely to be the victims of crime and the perpetrators of crime for all of the economic reasons, for all of the, you know, the reasons of stress, family stress. A child is 20 times more likely to be battered or sexually abused if her family earns less than $30,000 than if they earn more, 22 times. So, you know, poverty is at the base of so many bad things that happen to people. And I wish that the people who are thinking only about gender would think about some other things too. Gender is really important, but it's not the only important thing.
I think that class is important. I mean, in a lot of countries, prostitution is basically an economic problem, and that the prostitutes come from the lower economic classes because that's...
It's true here, too. It's true everywhere. I mean, the idea of the woman, you know, being a sex worker to pay her way through law school, that's a minority of sex workers, small minority.
Yes. I think drugs are also part of it, but that sort of also creates an economic problem. But I mean, there's entire classes in other countries where sex work is almost part of the culture because that's one of the few ways they can make a living. Anyway, I've greatly enjoyed this conversation about a difficult subject. I think you've made it easy to talk about. It is important, and I certainly didn't want to try to minimize the damage that sex assault can do, but sometimes good intentions lead to unintended consequences, and people get thrown under the bus who don't deserve to be thrown under the bus.
No, I think it's very important that you're talking about this, and I was happy to do it, and it's been fun for me, too.
Yeah,
so
well,
thanks for having
I'm
me.
I'm glad you you enjoyed talking to me, and I really appreciate your insights because you have a lot of good thoughts in this area, and you've also worked on a lot of different things and written a lot of things that have a lot of common sense in them, so I appreciate that. So thank you very much for joining me today.
Yeah, thank you, and Happy New Year.
Yes, Happy New Year to you, too.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And to our listeners, thank you for joining me for another episode of The Infectious Myth. A couple of weeks ago, I said I'd see you next year. I said I meant next week, but this time I will see you again next year in 2015. A couple of pieces of feedback. David on Facebook said, I very much enjoy your program commentary when you do not have a guest, which is nice to hear. I used to listen to Celia Farber, but then she disappeared. Perhaps you can have her as a guest one day soon. Stay strong, and I'll keep listening. Thanks very much. And I will add Celia to my list of future guests. I love talking to her. Lynette on Facebook also wrote, love your podcasts. They're so informative. Thank you. And thanks to you, my listeners. Goodbye and Happy New Year.